Hey everyone, we have a really exciting announcement. We are doing a live event on the 20th of May that you can definitely join because it's virtual. In partnership with Facebook, we will be in conversation with Wayne Jackson, Techish fan and WhatsApp engineer. Michael, what are we going to be talking about?
We're going to be talking about leveling up in tech, life of a Black engineer, how to break into tech as a software engineer, building features at WhatsApp, all kinds of amazing stuff. And then we're going to have a chance for Q&A with our amazing listeners.
And it's free, so all you have to do is click the link in show notes to apply. Spaces are limited, but we hope to see you there.
Yo, everyone, welcome back. Brand new Techish in the building. We back. It's Michael Behane with the amazing...
Abidesi.
Boop, boop. Let's go. So you told me off mic, you're really excited to talk about this whole Clubhouse thing. Explain
it's just
what Clubhouse
ridiculous.
Is, what happened to it. And who invested in it?
Wow. Okay. the spotlight is on me. Well, I think the startup world was kind of rattled the other day to find out that in the midst of this global pandemic and, you know, all the governors of central banks around the world declaring we're going to be going into recession, find out that this startup called Clubhouse has managed to raise $10 million at a $100 million valuation. It's not even the fact that they raised this amount of money. Mm-hmm. It's the combination of so many different things. One, like part of the deal that Andreessen Horowitz offered the founders meant that they would be walking away with $1 million each automatically, instantly, because they had like secondary shares. And it was also the fact that the app's only really been around for a few months. And also, it's only been in a private beta. And the only people who've been using the app in this private beta are VCs and other VCs. Oh, and briefly, Kevin Hart. So this story is pretty crazy because it looks like Benchmark and Andreessen Horowitz were basically in a race to lead this deal because this has been tipped as one of the hottest deals. So there's definitely a lot of hype around Clubhouse. And for folks who don't know, the idea is Clubhouse is trying to bring back intimate conversation. So it's this idea that we've got video calls, we've got Zoom, we've got house party, but Clubhouse is bringing it back to basics, bringing it back to simplicity. It's audio conversations. You basically like jump in, folks are already talking. Let's say, I don't know, Naval and Mark Andreessen are having a conversation. You open up the app, you can hear this conversation going on, and then you can select specific features to ask to join, raise a question, etc. So now it's worth mentioning that the founder has had previous exits. So in terms of playing the game, he had some experience to kind of know how can I really like play the VC game to my benefit. And what he did was he basically created this sense of he tapped into VC's like herd mentality and sense of competition and knew that if he could create a sense of urgency and exclusivity around this product and basically get VCs so excited and so hyped up about it that they would basically go into a bidding war amongst themselves. And that is exactly what happened. It got to the point where just in a bid to try and close the deal, the VCs were pulling all kinds of stops, even to the point where they were trying to get celebrities on the app just to be like, yo, we're the ones you want to bank with. and this is how Kevin Hart now found himself on Clubhouse.
who brought him on there?
So if I understand the story correctly, Benchmark have connections with the Hollywood scene. And so they thought that that was one of their one-ups over Andreessen Horowitz. So they were just like, oh, okay, you know, we're going to show the founders how much we care about this. We're going to like flex our Hollywood muscles to bring some celebs onto this, increase the sense of exclusivity that comes with using this app and increase the sense of quality that comes with this. So everyone who's on it is just like, wow, this is such a high value thing. This is incredible. Look at the quality of people on this. But despite that, you know, pulling out that card, they still went for Andreessen Horowitz. And many folks in the startup ecosystem are saying, you know, the reason they went for this is because if you look at the deal financially in terms of how it was structured, Andreessen Horowitz made cash instantly available to the founders in an unprecedented move for a seed round. And that's probably what sealed the deal. They basically got a kind of golden handcuffs vibe where they're just like, a milli each, let's do this. And I mean, hey, given the fact it hasn't even hit the market, we haven't even really proven it in terms of validation. I would be happy with $1 million. I'd take it. What do you think about Michael?
I mean, technically, it's a product that hasn't launched, right? Essentially, it's in private beta. So they have 2,000 users from what I can see in the articles that I've read.
There's more people on the Hustle Crew newsletter.
Absolutely, fam. There's more people listening to this podcast right now. There's our $100 million valuation. Thank you very much. God. No, I'm joking. But like, so 2,000 users, they've got $100 million valuation. They've taken money off the table. I mean, you know what? I hate to be that person, but like, how many, you know, underrepresented entrepreneurs are out here with genuine businesses, generating revenue, software businesses? I'm not talking about restaurants and whatnot. They can't raise a penny. And these guys are walking away millionaires and they haven't even produced a dime of revenue or even launched. I mean, you know what? I can't help for my mind to go there, but I'm not going to hate. You know what? If I respect them because it feels like to me, like you said, they tapped into the VC psychology and played them. They said, listen, absolutely, this is super exclusive. We've got these VCs on here. You want to be on here. So everybody's jumped on there by keeping it exclusive. It's worked for them. Now, the other criticism that I may have is that Andreessen Horowitz, they released the article Time to Build, however many a month ago. It feels like a lifetime ago, but they had the article essentially railing against the fact that we need to start building some real hard stuff.
Yeah.
We've been caught slipping by the COVID-19. Our cities are decrepit. We don't have any medical supplies. We're not doing anything serious. What's happening? And then you were like, okay, cool. Let's see what the investments are saying because, you know, all right, cool. You got the money. Like, talk is cheap. What are you actually investing in? Like, mm-hmm. And they've invested in a social app with no users. At $100 million valuation, right? Is that a sign of hypocrisy or is that just like, yo, the game's the game?
Do you know what it is, right? So you, folks who are listening now, I'm going to put my philosophy hat on. You know, when you read Aristotle and Plato, they talked about how like the ideal people to lead a society are a philosopher king. So it's this idea of someone that can combine best practices for governance with the attitude and the mindset of a philosopher, someone who's always willing to question what is the most fair, what is the most right, how should we be living as a society? Mm-hmm. That's what the ancient Greeks believed. And like a lot of early philosophers also thought, oh, well, what a perfect combination of a person. And I feel like sometimes when we look at venture capitalists and the way they behave, they sort of posit themselves a bit like a philosopher king. They're sort of 100%. Like, you know, we don't lead governments, but we lead capital. We lead the economy. Like, we are driving billions of dollars here and there and whatever, and we are shaping the future. Mm-hmm. And I think what we forget is, at the end of the day, they are just bankers in jeans. You know what I mean? Like, they're not like a new generation of people. Like, they are in finance. Like everyone else, they are in finance. So what are the incentives of people that work in finance, right? Now, we know our generation, many of the people listening, because we remember the last recession 10 years ago, the incentives of finance very rarely align with the incentives of society as a whole, right? Like, if we go all the way down to like the ordinary person, the average Joe and Jane, like, you know, they are not acting for our interests. And I think there's this really interesting sort of like distortion effect that's happening in terms of startups, where we have a lot of venture capitalists, some of the most respected and highly regarded, spouting these philosophical musings. But those are not in line with all of the actions that they take. So it's almost like they're diverting our attention away from the fact that they are stuck in a habit of pattern matching, stuck in a habit of basically backing bets that they've already backed before or that have a proven track record. But they'll say that we need to be more innovative and that we don't, you know, we don't have to always do what we did before. We need to do what's different. And I think, you know, to his credit, Clubhouse was built by Paul Davison, and he is someone who has a good track record of exits and acquisitions as, you know, as far as VCs go. So, you know, put my finance hat on, I'm looking at this guy and I'm like, okay, hang on a minute. He built an app that was acquired by Pinterest in 2016. He built another app in this space of like serendipitous socializing that was called Highlight that got a bit of buzz. Now he's building another app that's playing on all of these themes that he's got a track record in, social media, serendipity, and I know he had an exit to Pinterest. So if I'm putting my banker's glasses on, I'm seeing the dollar signs popping up, I'm just like, I want to get this guy in my portfolio. And you know, it's just, again, just going back to those incentives. And I think this for me is just like another helpful reminder for me to remember, like, I cannot rely on the venture capital industry to change the world the way I want the world to be changed. You see what I mean? Like, I can't rely on them social impact. I can't rely on them to reduce, you know, income inequality or anything like that. I can only rely on them to deliver returns to their limited partners. That is what they're going to do.
Okay, so let me challenge you. So do you think, you know, people have been railing against the fact that the social space essentially is dead? We've got Facebook, which is basically has an insurmountable position. Snapchat tried, but they kind of got handicapped by Facebook. TikTok's now coming out. We don't necessarily know what's going to happen there in the long term. And most capital dried up in the social space. Nobody was looking to invest in the social space because they were afraid, because Facebook was so dominant. Is there an argument to be made that by them investing in a social app, they are now actually saying, you know what, hold on, it's healthy for the economy if there are now multiple players where you can get your social fix? Is that something that has societal benefits? And that might be the argument that they would make and say, listen, well, elections have been jeopardized, or at least they've been claimed to be jeopardized by the fact that we've got this one platform. We need competition in this space, and this is what we're helping to provide.
So I think that's a really interesting point, but I almost want to say, how will you ensure that this actually provides healthy competition? The reason I'm saying that is because a lot of the reasons why there's monopolization of social media in a way is because of venture capital, right? Like, right, not solely and specifically, but what I mean to say is, you know, let's rewind, you know, our memories back to the beginnings of Facebook. Shoot, let's just remember the Social Network movie and what went down. As soon as investors got involved and saw the opportunity of what Facebook could be, they really, in a way, put Mark Zuckerberg on that rocket ship, right? And sent him out on this mission to dominate. So what I don't understand, based on that argument that you're saying, and I'm not saying it's wrong, and I'm not even saying there's an answer to it, because I think it's really complex, and, you know, it's easy for us to connect the dots looking backwards, but, you know, there's no guarantee that people assumed Facebook would get to the point where it is right now. But, you know, as it stands, the best indicator of the future is the past. So what we can see is when venture capital funds certain projects and they do succeed, you know, by virtue of their success, they've dominated the market. Are you really creating competition, or are you trying to create a replacement? Like, what's the true incentive again? What's the true motivation again?
That's the definition of competition. You try to replace the incumbent. And in that process, the quote unquote free market, you know, I'm just putting on my free market hat, that competition will benefit the consumer, right? That, in theory, the fact that Burger King is going for McDonald's means that McDonald's has to keep its prices low and can't, you know, poison its consumer, even though they probably are poisoning them with the food. But anyway, that's a whole other conversation.
You think it plays out like that?
I think it's hard to predict the future, but I think it's a good thing. If they had done three or four of those investments in the social space, and the key criteria is that Facebook can't acquire them, because if Facebook can just acquire them, then it's not going to make any bit of difference. And I think with the scrutiny on Facebook now, they probably are less able to acquire direct competitors anyway, because of the threat to break them up, essentially. I think it is a good thing, to be honest. So I've gone complete full circle and contradicted myself. Speaking of the audio space, one particular podcaster has made a whole lot of money. He goes by the name Joe Rogan, and he's now done an exclusive deal with Spotify. A lot of people are estimating that he's made at least $100 million per year in this new deal. So essentially now the Joe Rogan podcast, the largest podcast in the world, which gets 190 million monthly downloads, which is an insane number, now is behind the Spotify, not paywall, but behind, only available soon in the Spotify products. He will still have clips on YouTube, but the full podcast will only be available there. Estimates said that he was making $34 million himself alone as an independent podcast. And obviously Spotify have had to pay him the big bag to kind of strong arm him into coming on there. What are your thoughts? Like, what does it say about the podcast space in general? What does it say? You know, I've read some articles saying that he might even made a mistake because he was sitting on a much more valuable asset than he even realized potentially. And what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, it's so interesting. I was thinking about this because I was like, you know, when I think of podcasts and I think of them as a product, like monetization, all that kind of thing, the revenue, of course, comes from the sponsorship and comes from the adverts. And I was like, for Spotify to pay this much to acquire Joe Rogan, they must feel pretty confident that they're going to be able to pull in some advertising revenue that they couldn't pull in before. Or maybe even, to be honest, it could be like a user growth kind of thing where they're like, there's people that listen to this podcast that don't use Spotify. Let's turn them into premium users. So I thought that was like really interesting, just looking at it from like a strategic point of view, because obviously that is like a hell of a amount of cash, whatever it is. I think it also reminded me of the fact that if we think of maybe the growth of podcasts, if we think of it as a curve, in terms of like the steepness of that curve, like growing like, I guess we're actually still on the steep end of it. Like, you know, it's not really, you know, overheating mm-hmm. or dying out. I think there's like a lot of demand for it. And I think, you know, especially now, we're all kind of in flexible working. We have more time. People used to listen to podcasts on their commute. Now people can listen to podcasts all day because they don't have to go to the office. Yeah. So I thought that was really interesting. But, you know, finally, on the point you said, now you sent me that article, like, you know, a couple of days after the news broke, where someone had really broken down all of basically the failures that he thought Joe Rogan had failed to see in that deal, whether it was, you know, keeping control of his audience independently. I don't know. If I were Joe Rogan, I'd be happy with that deal. That's all I'm saying. I'd be happy with that deal. I feel like a bird in the hand is worth two in the bush. But I suspect you're going to have some different opinions, Michael. So you tell me what you would have done.
No, I think it depends on... I think from the outside, obviously Joe Rogan is a stand-up comedian. And I think he's taken the kind of stand-up comic model, which is the big thing is to get a show on Netflix or to get a show on HBO, right? They pay you, whatever, whatever. And the way that the article recommended that he go about maintaining his business and growing his business without Spotify was one where he would really have to be an entrepreneur and really have to be in the weeds of wanting to grow and build a business. And not everybody wants to do that. To clarify, the article said Joe Rogan should have just done a premium sponsored edition of his podcast weekly that maybe 1-2% of his audience would convert to. That would therefore lead to revenues in excess of $100 million per year on top of his existing podcast, right?
Now,
not everyone wants to do that work. Not everyone wants to be an entrepreneur. Not everyone wants to kind of build a platform that allows you to take donations or whatever. You could use Patreon, but you probably would want to do something in-house. So instead of that, he's like, listen, I want to carry on doing the show that I want to do and not have to worry about all of that overhead and just get paid $100 million a year. That's not bad, right? So I think it all depends on what you're after. But now where he's left money on the table is that Spotify stock went up by a few billion dollars.
But that isn't like realized capital, right? Like, okay, so the value of the stock has gone up. But that isn't real. Right. That isn't real. It isn't real money. It isn't real cash. Like, it's the value of the stock today. Right. But the thing is, it's like...
Go on.
It's not solely because of Joe Rogan, right? It's like the stock already had a value before the news was announced and Joe didn't play any part in that.
Right, yeah.
And now he's joined the company. It's grown up incrementally. Like really, the only thing he could be grateful for is like the difference, not necessarily the whole sum.
No, that's what I'm saying. But the difference was in the billions. So if, for example, if you got hired by a company and all of a sudden their stock went up by a few billion dollars, you're going to feel like, whoa, like I'm not really seeing the total value of what I'm giving to this company. That's what I would be thinking if that was me.
But the thing is, if Joe Rogan was worth billions, he would be making billions now.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see what I'm saying?
Not necessarily, because sometimes you don't fully tap in to the value that you're creating. That can happen quite often. For example, you know how Kanye was worth $1 billion now, basically, mm-hmm. right? Essentially, Yeezy was making $100 million per year.
Right.
Yeezy was making $100 million per year in terms of revenue and profits, right? So that was enough, sufficiently, for them to be valued at $1 billion, at a 10x multiple.
Halfway.
Now, if Joe Rogan had done it where he was like, oh, let me just like do my own premium subscriber feed, Q&A, whatever, whatever, and got, you know, 3% of his audience to convert and then led to $100 million a year in revenue, which is possible, technically speaking, he would have a $1 billion podcast. You know what I'm saying? On paper, at least. But regardless of any, you know, he's made his deal. Good for him.
People too greedy out there,
man. What does it say about podcasting in general?
People too greedy out there. People too greedy
out
there. You
think so?
No, man. This guy just made $100 million. People saying, yo, you could have made more. Like it's just crazy.
But I'm saying,
just had this conversation about Clubhouse being overvalued and stuff like that. We're now jumping on this story and being like, $100 million? Nah, he should have got more. He should have squeezed everything out of it. Blah, 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 blah. Like, you know, we're speaking hypotheticals.
I'm putting myself in Joe's shoes here, and my personal philosophy is I don't want a dollar less than what's mine, and I don't want a dollar more than what's mine. So what I'm saying is if I feel like this is the value that I'm bringing, I want my value. That's what I'm saying. Like, it's the same principle why if someone comes to me and says, oh, I'm negotiating my salary at work, I'm like, go for the amount, go for it, go for the six figures. Tell them that's what you're off, that's what you're worth, right? Obviously, it's a completely different scale. I know what you mean. It does seem a bit obscene, the fact that we're saying, no, it's not enough, 100 million is not enough. But the other thing I wanted to mention, so obviously now he's abandoning that feed, right? And he's going onto the Spotify feed, right? Which is separate because Spotify doesn't use the open kind of RSS format. They have their own kind of closed off feed, which a lot of people don't like, which is why, like, if you have a podcast, it doesn't automatically go on Spotify. You have to manually go there and upload it. And it has to be approved by Spotify. It's a closed ecosystem, essentially. But regardless, anyway, so now he's building up a new feed on Spotify, right? Building an audience on Spotify. Now, let's say he's at Spotify for 4 or 5 years, right? His existing Apple feed will depreciate. People will leave because they're like, well, you're not on here, so I'm going to unsubscribe. What's the point, right? His argument was, oh, listen, it doesn't make a difference. After this Spotify deal, I'm just going to go back to my old Apple feed, right? Worst case scenario, right? Mm. But to a certain extent, you're abandoning ownership of your own audience. So let's say he goes to Spotify with 1 million subscribers. He brings 1 million over with him. He builds it up to 2 million subscribers on Spotify. When he leaves Spotify, that extra 1 million subscribers is gone. He doesn't own that anymore. He's going back to his old feed, which may now have 500,000 subscribers, right? Because they've all left, right? So this is not without risk. When you lose ownership of your audience, you can play yourself, like, and this is why that short-term money, as exciting as it can be, it can be risky. Like, and I think it's my own feeling of like being really big on ownership. And like, I'm like, yo, own your own shit. Own your own email newsletter. Own your own...
The mic method.
Own your audience, right? The mic method. Don't have a middleman, like, you know what I'm saying, as much as possible. And this is setting up a middleman. But listen, Joe Rogan will be fine. Joe Rogan ain't starving. But this is more of a lesson for other podcasters out there who may be listening thinking, all right, cool. How do I optimize?
One last thing.
Yeah.
There's going to be creators and founders and technologists, creatives, everyone in our community who are thinking about the fact that at some point in time, some corporation is going to come at them and try and acquire what they have created or, like, you know, take it over as a partnership or whatever. Now, basically, right, up until this point, you basically said that, like, there's only two ways. You either stay independent or, you know, you sell. Is there a middle ground? Mm-hmm. Like, is there a way that you can, let's say, separate the product from yourself? And let's say in Joe Rogan's case, like, okay, fine, I will give you the Joe Rogan podcast. But surely Joe Rogan can continue to build the Joe Rogan following in other ways, independent of the audio that he's creating for the podcast. Or is that not doable? Because I'm just saying, like, surely there has to be a way for people out there to be strategic about the ways they can protect their own IP as well as their credibility and all those things they've done, but still at the same time maximize those opportunities to sell off whatever brand, content, or, you know, product they've created.
I mean, I think he probably saw this as the intermediate because he hasn't sold the rights to the show. He's just given Spotify a licensing deal. So at the end of that licensing deal, he can go back to what he was doing beforehand. But what I'm just saying is that might be a bit risky because you're going to depreciate what you've already built on an independent level. There probably is another way that probably even optimizes even better. I don't know what that is. Podcasting is very unique. And I'd have to sit there and think about it, right? But I think the temptation in life, just like in any startup, in any business, is that when someone dangles a big check to help you exit, you just want to take it, like, because you're tired. You're like, you know what? I could do this. I could make, you know, 20% of what they're offering me every year and build it up slowly, or I can just take the one-time payment offer and just be like, yeah, please, man, I want to get rich right now. And that's always a tricky thing. Like, if someone comes to you, let's say you have a small business making $1 million a year, and someone comes and they're like, yo, I'll give you 50 million right now. You may make the 50 million in the next 10, 12, 15 years, but you're just like, you know what, let me just take that money now and let this person run with it, right? And that's always the thing to balance. I want to do a quick second shout out to Quaver from the Migos. He actually went back and got his high school diploma at 29 years old, and he shouted it out and was really proud and put some pictures out. And yeah, just I think it's really admirable for someone to go back and at 29 years old as a multi-millionaire to go back and get, you know, formal academic qualifications when you blatantly don't need to. And there's been a trend of a lot of like hip hop artists going back to do that. So I think Nick Cannon went back and got a degree from Howard. I know Swiss Beats went back and got like an MBA from Harvard, which is fucking amazing. And these people are all like, you know, tens of millions plus net worth. They don't really need to go back and get an education, but the value in that kind of knowledge, you know, still transcends necessarily your net worth. So yeah, credit to everybody involved and face your books, people. The other thing I wanted to talk about in terms of podcasting, it was the most hilarious story I've read all week. And it's similar to what we were talking about now. So there's this podcast called Call Her Daddy. I never even heard of this podcast. I never even was aware of this podcast. Essentially, it was two young ladies. I haven't got their names in front of me. They launched a podcast independently, right? And essentially, it got like a few thousand downloads. It was doing moderately okay. Like, then this company called Barstool was like, listen, we like what we're doing. We're going to acquire your podcast and we're going to help you scale it. So they have complete ownership over the IP because they came in quite early. Eventually, they scaled up their podcast to have like a million downloads. Both ladies have now a million plus followers on Instagram.
Wow.
They're influencers in their own right. The account for the podcast app on Instagram has a million followers as well. So they're big, big. They're a big, big deal. Now, one of the ladies has a boyfriend who works at HBO as an executive. He's quote unquote nicknamed Suitman on the podcast. They call him Suitman. He whispered in the ear of his girlfriend and said, listen, you guys are getting ripped off. You guys are getting ripped off. You deserve more money. It turns out they were earning $500K a year each as podcasters, right? So Suitman told his girlfriend, listen, we need to shop this podcast around. You guys could be making millions a year. This Barstool company is killing it off you guys, off the back of your sweat and labor. So in the end, the podcast wasn't having any new episodes. So then a new episode arrived on the feed and it turned out it was the CEO of Barstool. He hijacked the feed, hijacked the Instagram account, but he has ownership of all of it and said, yo, this is my side of the story. These girls have got super greedy, like, and this is what's happening. And actually the audience, surprisingly, sided with the CEO of Barstool. They're like, yeah, we like this guy.
Oh my god! Right, fans be fickle, yo!
Yeah, yo, but the thing is, listen, if you're doing a podcast and your whole thing is like, oh, we're broke young girls in our 20s, right? Mm-hmm. And we can understand your struggle and we're doing, you know what I mean? But deep down, you're making $500,000 a year and that gets exposed, your audience feels a bit betrayed. Like,
that's a good point, yeah.
The only thing I'm glad about our podcast is that if you're listening to us, if you listen to Techish, obviously you resonate with our message and maybe our struggle, but at the same time, you want to see us do well because we're tech entrepreneurs, we're tech executives, like... And if we do well, it doesn't necessarily take away. In fact, you probably got more to learn from us, right? But with this podcast, Call Her Daddy, you know, they just became less relatable and people kind of sided with the dude CEO saying like, you guys are kind of greedy. You're getting paid $500,000 just to come in and talk shit once a week. Like, come on, like. It's like, this is like, has everything. It has to do with ownership. It has to do like when brands have to come in and own influencers. You can't really own the influencer now, can you? Like, this is not, they're not the quote unquote talent anymore. They're their own business entity.
Wow.
And they can do whatever the fuck they want.
But you know what? Like, I wonder sometimes, like, should, like, this kind of reminds me. So basically, this just reminds me of, do you remember when the Friends actors, like, this is when we were kids.
Yep.
And at the time, I didn't really understand money.
Yep.
But I remember hearing in the news how they were getting paid $1 million an episode.
Yep.
Do you remember?
Yep. They negotiate together, right?
They negotiate together. Exactly. And then this became this, like, huge thing. And at the time, I was too young to really understand, like, what that really meant. But there's something really interesting that happens like within media. And again, like, you know, technology and media, like our worlds are becoming more and more merged all the time. But the value of talent in media is very high. It's very high, isn't it? Like people get paid millions and millions and millions to like show up and be themselves and perform.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So I guess it's really difficult because, you know, I understand exactly as you've broken it down, like the kind of betrayal of the fans because, you know, they were like these kind of 20-something coming up girls, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, at some point they crossed over into hot property, into desirable talent from a media perspective. So they went from like indie maker kind of people doing their thing, creatives, into, you know, media professionals that were sought after for their talent. And the reason I'm bringing this up is because surely that trend that you've just been talking about is only going to keep growing, especially now with platforms like TikTok, etc. Like it's always going to be the fact that there's going to be someone in their bedroom doing a bit of this, doing a bit of that. I mean, this is how Justin Bieber started, right? Usher found him on YouTube. Yeah. And it's like, you know, why is it that there are some people that we as a fan base or a general public are happy to see do the rags to riches, and then others where we're just like, nah, that's shady. We don't like it.
I mean, listen, it depends on your narrative that you're portraying. Like, if you're a rapper and you're like, yo, I've got all the money, I got whatever, I'm not going to be mad at you when it turns out that you're rich. In fact, I'll be more upset when I find out that you're not rich, right? But if I'm listening to a podcast and it's like, yo, the struggle, I'm a young girl just like you, I'm relatable just like you, and then it turns out actually, like, you're hella rich and you're being a bit greedy at that, I'm just going to be like, what was I really listening to this whole time? I feel like I've been lied to. Just be honest, innit? If you're rich, you're rich. That's what I don't have a problem with listening to people that are rich. Be rich and just let me know what it's like to be rich. I want to hear that sometimes, right? And I think it's just about being transparent with your audience, right? And the messaging that you're putting across. That's my personal philosophy. Unless I'm sure there's a percentage of people that might hate on you anyways. Like even if you're transparent about how successful you are, like there's going to be haters no matter what. But I just find the story interesting about, it's like what we said about the Joe Rogan. Who owns the IP? This is what Joe Rogan did that was clever. His is a licensing deal. But these young girls, because they started so early and partnered up so early, they gave away all of the ownership of the podcast, Call Her Daddy. Like, they gave away everything. The Instagram account. I mean, all they have now is their own personal IG account, which is great. You know, they could probably launch a new podcast and still do okay. But, like, make sure you don't give away ownership too soon. That's the problem. Like, a lot of, like, young people just get fandangled by, like, people with checkbooks and like, oh, like, yeah, we'll pay you, but we own all of this and you're building immense value for somebody else. Like, you don't even know how much value this person is. Like, they're getting paid 500k a year.
Yeah,
you don't know this guy was making about 5-10 million, $20 million a year off their podcast. Like,
wow.
Honestly, to invest $1 million a year, go on.
No, I was just going to say, so interestingly, like, sometimes people approach me in a way, like a partnership kind of thing, like, oh, we develop courses, we do this, we do that, blah, blah, blah. And I have learned to ask them, like, what is your projected revenue for this? Because they're always trying to be really cagey about that. Like, oh, how much would you charge for this kind of thing? Or like, how much would you charge that? And I was like, well, you know, I'm always really truthful where I was like, that isn't the typical type of work I do. I usually either consult with clients or I like deliver training or whatever. And they're like, yeah, but we just want to like co-brand this with you. And a part of me, like, my red flags always go up because I'm like, okay, well, if it's a co-branded thing that's going to be sold like in perpetuity, we got a revenue share this thing. And they'll always try to be like, no, we want to pay you a fee. We want to pay you a fee. And like, I've literally like stopped talking to certain companies because of that, because I don't want to end up in that situation you've just described where I don't know how much someone can potentially make with my collaboration. Cause it's like, nah, I want transparency. And the other thing I was going to say is, this is one of your favorite things to bring up because you're all intellectual and stuff. But like, isn't this such a good example of like the prisoner's dilemma and why you should absolutely like not turn your back on the other prisoner, but actually like collaborate with them and like find a way to get the best deal? Because I feel that once these two hosts stop talking to each other, it's exactly when things started to go wrong for them.
Oh, listen, it's classic, like when the police get you and your, you know, friend in the room separately and they're like, yeah, man, your friend's talking, man. You better start talking, fam. So like the strength and unity. By the way, I don't think I've ever brought up the prisoner's dilemma, but thank you for praising me.
No, you have. You definitely have brought up the dilemma in the podcast before. Because I remember when you did, I was like, okay, this guy bringing me back to my econ lectures.
Cool. all right, cool. That's interesting. So there's an artist called Doja Cat. She had a number one recently with Nicki Minaj. I haven't heard any of her music. I'm an old fuddy-duddy. I don't know any of these new artists. I'm not Gen Z, so don't hate on me. Anyway, she went to number one with Nicki, and she has a solid fan base. She's actually of mixed heritage. She's half South African, half white. And essentially, people found footage of her on internet forum with like a lot of these kind of incel white gamers. And I never knew how racist the gaming community is actually, but a lot of like,
it's crazy.
Researching.
Yeah, and
I didn't even know
how people
got.
They proper dox people, yeah.
Yeah, so anyway, she was caught on there essentially saying anti-black stuff. What she actually said, I'm not too sure, but anyway, they started like a whole campaign essentially, like, you know, cancel Doja Cat, whatever.
Wow.
And then there's an old song like surfaced called It Didn't Do Nothing, basically. And it's basically Didn't Do Nothing is a racist response that a lot of like alt-right people say about black people who have been killed by the police, and they will spell it like D-I-N-D-U, basically taking the piss out of like quote-unquote Ebonics and making it out as if like black people can't speak. So she had a track named Didn't Do Nothing, basically. So people are like, hold on, what's going on? You're obviously of mixed heritage, you're half black, right? And in America, that technically means that you're kind of racialized as black just due to the one drop rule. And that's a whole other conversation, right? So like, what's up with you, man? What's up with the self-hate? Like, and do you continue to support somebody who has that much self-hatred? Like, if you're a fan of this artist, like, like, what do you do? Like, I don't know. Like, I was reading, you talked about Akala's book.
Natives.
Yeah, which is really good.
Reading. That book. Yeah, like, Lord.
I was rereading it, and he talks about sometimes we focus too much on personal examples of bigotry and not enough on the structural. And it's easy to be like, oh, look at this poor person. Look how stupid and racist they are, right? But instead, You know, for example, he says that you might get like an academic professor who will say it's wrong to call people the N-word, but then spend his whole career justifying the British Empire. So these kind of structural, you know, factors of racism are ignored, but that kind of impolite personal racism is all we want to focus on.
Absolutely.
Now, I agree with that, but I do think we still have to hold people to some extent accountable to their words and at least, you know, say to them, yo, that's not on, you know, like, and people don't want to support you. They don't have to.
Honestly, like, I'm so glad you brought this up because I saw this like trending on Twitter and people talking about it. And like you said, I'm like listening to Carla's book Natives on Audible at the moment. And honestly, such a great book. Everyone, please check it out. But it's so difficult. I feel like it's so difficult to unpack the structural oppression and the structural racism because those structures are also the composite of individual actors. Like, 100%. Of course, I know there's like legislation and policy and strategy that, you know, backs them up and that cannot be changed as easily because there's, you know, restrictions around how things like law changes.
Right.
But ultimately, like, you know, the police force is still made up of individual people within the police force and even like the media, right? Because we talk about the media law and the media plays a big role in reinforcing the status quo.
But let me hold you up because I think you're saying something really clever. And I don't want people to lose. You're essentially saying that so structural racism is made up of individuals who are individually racist. So for me to say, oh, not worrying about individual acts of racism is irrelevant, doesn't make sense because when you add those cases all up, eventually that leads to the structural. That's
exactly
what you're saying, right?
Exactly.
Oh, I didn't want our audience to lose that because I thought that was a really clever point. So carry on, sorry. I just wanted to follow that following, yeah.
So that's what makes it really complicated because if we say, for example, we want the media to not reinforce white supremacy, homophobia, sexism, misogyny, anything like that, the media is still individual journalists, broadcasters, musicians, producers, all these individual people with their own spheres of influence and their own platforms for sending and amplifying messages. So it's really, really, really tough, right? Because at the same time, now I know that these structures are basically lots of different individuals added up with also maybe like laws and stuff to back them up and support them. It's tough because I also know as an individual and as someone that practices, you know, compassion for other people and stuff like that, individuals make mistakes. And also people grow and people change. And there are a lot of people, most people regret something they did in the past.
Right.
And creatives are the type of people that are willing to make themselves vulnerable for our entertainment, right? And let's remember that, like, you know, artists get a lot of flack, but it's really hard to be an artist. It's really hard to put yourself out there. Everyone who's listening right now and hasn't started a business that they've been having an idea for years and years and years, imagine that, but it's a song or a painting or a poem or a lyric. It's even harder, right?
It's a bit deeply personal.
Yeah, so I just find it so hard on a personal level to cancel people or call people out, especially if they are in the space of creating and doing something that's quite subjective and personal. Because like, I know for a fact that like, whatever she felt in that moment where she was saying those things or doing those things isn't necessarily the person that she is today. That's how I feel.
I don't think it was that long ago. This is what I'm saying though. I don't think what she was caught in those chat rooms saying was even a significant amount of time ago. So it's not a thing of like, oh, she's grown. You know what I'm saying? She's actually just been caught.
But do you think she knows the context of the things that she's saying?
I don't want to infantilize her in that way and say she's ignorant and she doesn't know what she's talking about. But what I will say is this, is that there are millions of artists in the world, right? And I feel like, for example, like black audiences, black women in particular, like, because there was a time like a few weeks ago in UK black Twitter where there was a lot of anti-black tweets that were surfaced from a lot of like UK black influencers from like 2012, 2013. And a lot of them were directed against black women, like dark skinned women, a lot of like horrible stuff, right? And the question people said is that, listen, why are like black people and then black women in general always the brunt of this? Now, if you are a black woman and someone's tweeted something mad about dark skinned women in the past, listen, it's not always up to you to be the forgiving person. You might just be like, you know what? There's millions of other artists out here. There's millions of other influencers out here. I'm just checking out because you're not that individual and unique where like, I have to support you, right? And that's up to every person to make that question. If you're just like, no, I'm in a forgiving mood. All right, cool. That's up to you. But if you're just like, you know what? Tired of this. There's too many other artists out here for me to have to support somebody who's got this much self-hate or who's like said this much foolish stuff. Like, I'm out. So I think it's up to everybody to kind of make that decision and choice. Is there a space where we can be more forgiving? Probably. Is there a space where we can be like more constructive and helping people learn and grow? Probably. But some people are tired of that. Some people are like, you know what? Like, why did it take you to 22 to realize that black people are people too? Or like, why did it take you to 23, 24 to realize? Do you know what I mean? So yeah, it's a sad situation, full stop.
We just have to also remind creators that they do play a role in like activism. Like I was thinking this the other day, can you be a creator, creative from a marginalized group and not bring the oppression or struggle of your community into the work that you create? Like, is that possible?
Yeah, I've always had this debate. I don't think you directly have to, you know, speak out necessarily, but I hate when people say to people like, oh, this is a conscious rapper. So I'm like, so then who are the other rappers unconscious? Like, what are you trying to say? Are they asleep?
They're AI.
Because to be honest, like, yeah, you know what I mean? Because it's like things are more political than people realize. So like if you're a rapper, for example, and all you're talking about is German cars, Italian clothes, and French champagne, you are sending me a political message. You just don't realize it. You're telling me that European brands and European things are what I should aspire to. Now to you, you're like, I'm not political. I'm just saying what, you know, what's hot in my hood or what everybody aspires to. But no, you are sending me a message. You just don't realize it. So sometimes people who think they're not giving out a message actually are. It's just a negative one, right? Now, whether you have to come out here and be Muhammad Ali, I don't necessarily know. Like, you know, like, that's a difficult thing. Not everyone,
even for the
not
top
everyone's
over
built
there.
For that. Not everyone's built for that. Yeah, not everyone's built for that. Like, not everyone wants to come out here and sacrifice that much. And it reminds me of the Michael Jordan documentary, Last Dance. I never watched all of it, but there was like a political election happening, right? And he's notorious for keeping quiet. He donated to the Democratic person who was running, I think, for like a local election. And they said, Michael, man, why don't you come out and say more? And he was like, listen, Republicans buy sneakers too, right? So this is why a lot of people don't want to come out and say shit, because they're like, I don't want to jeopardize my probably white majority buying audience. So how much of people not speaking is cowardice? How much of it is just, you know, I'm ignorant, I don't have much to say? Like, a lot of people are just like ignorant. They're like, I'm a rapper, I'm a singer, I don't know about geopolitics and about, you know, anti-black racism on a deep systemic level. Like, I don't know what to say. Mm-hmm. I don't know. What do you think? Do you think you should come out there and say stuff?
It's just interesting because I was having this conversation with my sister yesterday in the context of Black AF and the feedback to that. And I was just saying, like, I do think just in the context of the times that we're in, and in a way, maybe the times we've always lived in, especially what's happening in America, the shootings and stuff like that, I'm not saying it has to be at the core of everything you do, but I also think at the same time, it would be very difficult for you to ignore it or avoid it altogether. See what I'm saying? Like, I feel that like anyone from a marginalized group right now, underrepresented group, or any group that's really being oppressed and facing violence and things like that, it has to be a part of what you do to some degree, even if it's just like either like your values or whatever, because it's unavoidable. Surely it's just unavoidable. Like, social justice work now is just kind of unavoidable. Yeah, that's how I feel about it.
And it's interesting, just one last point. So there's a Black British comedian here called Lenny Henry. And for a long time, he was like the only Black British comedian that was on TV for years. Mm-hmm. Sounds crazy to our American listeners, but that's how like boxed off and the gatekeepers have so much control over UK media that this one Black guy was the only real Black UK comedian that was on mainstream platforms. And I used to kind of hate on him. I used to be like, I don't feel like he's bringing anybody in. I don't see him supporting any other Black comedians. He just kind of seems to be happy and content being the only Black in the village, basically. Mm-hmm. But then I looked at this and more research because I was debating with my friend, and it turned out that on the low, he was supporting people. Wow. He invested a lot of money in like Black institutions. He actually is now an LP at a Black VC fund that me and you are both aware of, but we just don't know. We didn't look at who the LPs were, right? And he's on the board. So sometimes what someone is doing front and center isn't all they're doing. So we can be quick to be like, oh, this person's not supporting nothing, man. But actually on the low, they might be. So that's also another complication.
Applications are still open for the Future Startup Now program. It's a virtual program, but it is for Londoners, founded by Mayor of London. So if you're 18 to 24 years old from an underrepresented background, I'm talking Black and brown, female, disabled, working class, etc. We want to hear from you. It's a 5-week program. You're going to be taught all the fundamentals of launching a business by folks like myself and other cool folks from Snapchat and great companies. And at the end, you also have a chance to pitch for a 5K grant from the Mayor of London. So it's a pinned tweet on my Twitter profile. Please click the link and apply if that's you.
Dope. Yo, everyone. Thank you for listening to this week's Techish. We'll catch you next week. Please use the hashtag Techish. Subscribe to our Patreon if you still want some more. We've got some exclusive-ish on there for our subscribers. And we'll catch you next week. Peace.
Bye.